From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! The situation is getting increasingly grave in East Timor, this after the Timorese voted overwhelmingly for independence from Indonesia. Indonesian regime-backed militiamen are rampaging through the streets of Dili, the capital, and other towns and villages, killing scores of Timorese. Westerners are evacuating. Also today, an interview with renowned novelist Howard Fast. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with urgent news from Dili, East Timor. The situation is extremely grave. For those of you who haven't heard, late Friday night in the United States, Kofi Annan, UN Secretary General, announced from the United Nations that the East Timorese had overwhelmingly voted for independence in East Timor in an historic referendum that took place on August 30th. The ballots counted up finally by Friday night. But since then, pro-Indonesian militiamen, supported by the Indonesian regime, have been rampaging through the streets. We have this report from Dili, East Timor, although Associated Press, Reuters, and most of the news organizations have pulled out at this point from East Timor because of the violence. The report says that militiamen set fire to the home of the East Timorese Nobel Peace Laureate today, and that heads of victims were reportedly displayed on sticks outside the capital in a rampage following the territory's vote for independence. Days of rioting prompted thousands to flee East Timor, and Australia launched an airlift to evacuate UN elections officials and Australians from the territory. A top UN envoy met in Jakarta with the Indonesian president amid accusations that Indonesian security forces are doing nothing to halt the bloodshed. That's the AP report. The reports we have from eyewitnesses on the ground is that they are doing something. They are actually involved in that bloodshed and have been involved in the killings. We turn right now to Darwin, Australia, where a number of Westerners have been airlifted out of East Timor. John Miller is with us. He's one of the coordinators of the East Timor Action Network and was in East Timor with another organization to observe the referendum.
I was there with parliamentarians for East Timor with a delegation of Dutch, British, and Scottish MPs.
Can you tell us what the situation is like right now?
Well, from everything I was hearing and some of what I was seeing before I left, there were burning houses in a number of particularly pro-independence neighborhoods in East Timor. Unknown numbers of people have been killed. As you mentioned, even church facilities are not being respected, even though thousands of refugees have gathered there at Bishop Bello's residence, at seminaries, at convents in the area. It's quite serious. It's actually the worst of what people feared, that if the East Timorese expressed their will and voted for independence, the Indonesian military would not accept that and would punish the East Timorese people for their desire for freedom, basically.
How did you get out of East Timor? You've been there for a number of weeks now.
The Australian government has organized an airlift. I came out on one of their military planes, probably 100 of us, both foreign observers, foreign aid workers, and what they're calling non-essential UN personnel are being airlifted, and I was on the first of what I think was supposed to be 5 flights this evening and possibly more tomorrow.
We hear about pro-Indonesian militiamen. Can you talk about who groups like ITARIC are and Yuriko Gutierrez and what exactly they're doing in the streets right now?
Well, from all reports, they're just rampaging through the streets, not only of Dili, where there's at least some reporting coming out, both from the UN, from observers like myself, and from whatever media is left, but also from but out in the countryside in smaller towns and villages, which the UN has already evacuated its personnel and the foreign observers have already left in the recent days. And there's been reports of massacres, of people being forced onto trucks and being taken to West Timor, where they're presumably Indonesia is going to try and use that as evidence that there's some flaw in the ballot result and that they're, you know, how could independents have won by such a large margin if so many people are fleeing the result, and it's really people being coerced and dragged out of their homes and brought to West Timor. We've heard reports, as I mentioned, of journalists being attacked and threatened. But what's clear is that the levels of violence are different when it deals with different people. So, for example, houses that I've stayed in Dili have been threatened. Militia have come marching by. They've rattled the gate, but they've actually not physically harmed any foreign observer that I know of, and you know, very few UN personnel and only a handful of journalists. And clearly they could have. I've talked to UN people who have had guns pointed at them, but then had the gun fired in the air. But when it comes to the East Timorese themselves, you know, they know who they want to target, which neighborhoods they want to target, which villages they want to target, and they're doing it quite ruthlessly.
We have reports from the center where you are in Darwin, Australia, the East Timorese International Support Center, that say more than 170 people were slaughtered today by the Indonesian-backed militias.
Any totals have to be purely speculative at this point. It could be dozens, it could be hundreds. I fear, actually, it could be thousands, and that is Shinana Gushmao, the East Timorese resistance leader, has warned that this is could be another East Timorese genocide in the making, and that nobody's able to really travel around Dili. One of the people I was staying with has done some moving of refugees, and another person worked in the motel clinic where, you know, at least four or five dead and larger numbers of wounded have been brought in over the past 3 or 4 days. But what the total adds up to, we may never know. Indonesia's been always, you know, buried the bodies, and, you know, all counts have ended up always being speculative.
We're talking to John Miller, who was one of the international observers in East Timor. He's just been evacuated to Darwin, Australia. And, John, I just got this urgent message over the Internet, news coming from Dili, East Timor, that the already tense situation has become completely chaotic. All the remaining 22 international observers with the International Federation for East Timor Observer Project, known as IFET, are fleeing East Timor. I spoke to someone who said they were on their way to the airport trying to make their way through militia roadblocks with Australian government help. Any word on that situation?
That's exactly the same word we have. Indonesia and the Indonesian military remains in charge of East Timor and has no respect for international law, international pressure, international or East Timorese opinion.
I understand the general of the Indonesian military, Wiranto, and Foreign Minister Ali Alatas were in East Timor this weekend. The militia, which in the past have had machetes and other sort of homemade weapons, now are using more and more automatic weapons.
Yeah, well, General Wiranto's response to international criticism has been that I'm going to send in more police or more troops, when at a minimum, and police have just stood by, either too scared or told to back off whenever the militias act up. And certainly in the case of the military itself, have actively been assisting in training and directing militia activity and actually carrying out some of the atrocities themselves. I heard reports from people that had seen it wasn't the militias burning the houses, lighting them afire. It was Indonesian soldiers themselves. The solution is clearly that the Indonesian military has to withdraw and be replaced by some international force. I don't think it would take much to end the militia activity. I think they're very much controlled by the Indonesian military, and they could stop it if they wanted to. And if there are any remnants of it that weren't under the military control, I would be very surprised, and they would certainly dissipate very quickly without support from the Indonesian military. How to make that happen, I think, is up to everybody, both governments and people around the world, to really send the strongest possible messages to Indonesia that this has to stop, and that the UN or some coalition of countries has to be allowed in to restore order in East Timor and allow this process of decolonization that Indonesia blocked in 1975 to go forward.
John Miller, we have been hearing words from the Assistant Secretary of State, Stanley Roth, saying that international aid could be cut off if Indonesia doesn't stop the violence against the Timorese. We understand a letter was sent by President Clinton to Habibie, the president of Indonesia, but we haven't seen actions, an actual U.S. cutoff of military weapons sales to Indonesia.
I mean, these threats have been made, and I've been heartened that the U.S. policy has moved that far. But it's clear that at this point, it's not the threats aren't working, and that action has to be taken. That the loans have to be suspended. That whatever remaining U.S. arms, spare parts, ammunition are in the pipeline have to be cut off. That any hints and nudges from the Pentagon that their training might be restored, or, you know, we think the Indonesian military is wonderful because it keeps order throughout Indonesia itself, you know, that has to stop, and that it has to be a clear and consistent message.
One of the few Western journalists left in East Timor is Alan Nairn, and we've been talking to him each day with his reports from Dili. He has gotten information on the connection between the U.S. military and the militias. Is there a sketch that you have, the outline of what that information, since we're not able to reach him now, is?
He has minutes of meetings held by U.S. military officials with Indonesian military officials around the times of the worst violence, pre-election violence in East Timor. And those minutes aren't the U.S. military saying your human rights violations have to stop, you have to respect your word under the May 5th UN agreement that established the vote. It's basically saying we think you're wonderful, we're working hard to restore your military training. We're working hard to not only restore what's cut off, but to expand it. We want to see arms sales restored. It's the exact opposite message that the State Department was giving. It's the exact opposite message that we were led to believe that the Pentagon was delivering. But we were told, and I know East Timorese leaders were told, that the Pentagon was on the same page exactly with U.S. policy, and everybody was telling the Indonesian government and the Indonesian military that this process had to go smoothly and that there would be consequences if it didn't. What the Pentagon was basically saying is, we don't care how this process goes. We're with you 100%.
What other evidence does he have of U.S. connection to the violence in East Timor?
He's also interviewed a number of Indonesian generals, who say things to the same effect, that's my understanding, as well other documents that show a close connection between U.S. trained Indonesian military officials and those same officials who have been directing and planning and been the moving force behind the militias and no doubt behind the current violence that's going on in East Timor.
Well, we hope to bring our listeners a direct report from East Timor, from Alan Nairn, tomorrow on Democracy Now!, a very desperate situation in East Timor as we speak.
It's a very hard time for outside observers, but so we have to be very clear that it's a far worse time for the East Timorese themselves. Their hope is shattered, I think, and if things aren't done quickly, we may be talking about this period as the third great massacre of the East Timorese people following World War II and following the period after the Indonesian invasion.
John, do you think calls to President Clinton would help?
Absolutely. I was watching CNN in Dili as President Clinton gave the most mealy-mouthed statement I ever saw from him, which says quite a lot, you know, in a situation that really called for a very clear and firm announcement that arms sales, spare parts, ammunition were being cut off, that the U.S. was going to go to the international loan agencies, the World Bank and the IMF, and move for those loans to be blocked until Indonesia stops its violence. It's not the militias, it's not East Timorese against East Timorese, it's the Indonesian military and the Indonesian government against the East Timorese people.
John Miller, from the East Timor Action Network, just evacuated from Dili, East Timor, where he had been observing the referendum that just took place, where East Timorese voted overwhelmingly for independence from Indonesia. As Westerners are evacuated, the people of East Timor are trapped with their murderers, the Indonesian military, and their proxies, the Indonesian militias. We'll bring you more on the situation tomorrow.
There is no blackout doctor. No business deal big enough. No heart hollow. No grave wide
enough
to bury your story, to keep it from us. Love from a short distance.
Continuing with our Labor Day special, we bring you an extended interview with acclaimed novelist and author Howard Fast. Howard Fast, who in 1952 ran for Congress on the Labor Party ticket on the platform of independence for Puerto Rico, ending racism and anti-Semitism, and ending the war in Korea. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here with Jeremy Scahill. And we're sitting in the living room of Howard Fast, renowned author of historic fiction and the most prolific radical writer of the 20th century. His books range from Spartacus about the slave revolt against the Roman Empire to The Passion of Sacco and Vanzetti, the celebrated case of the two executed anarchists. He's written more than 50 books, including his memoir, which is called Being Read. Howard Fast was a war correspondent, jailed for his beliefs during the McCarthy era, and was also a dear friend of Paul Robeson. Can you tell us about the Joint Anti-Fascist Refugee Committee?
Well, you know, the first defense against fascism was in Spain, when Franco took his army, his Moroccan army, across the Straits of Gibraltar, and invaded Spain to overthrow the Republic, the newly founded Republic of Spain. When that happened, the Spaniards, who were unprepared for a major war, fought against Franco, and Franco was very quickly joined by both Hitler and Mussolini, particularly by Hitler testing his Stuka dive bombers and his other weapons there in Spain. And ultimately, Spain was defeated. And a tremendous amount of Republican soldiers and their families fled north over the mountains, over the Pyrenees, to Toulouse. Now, in a group of us headed by Dr. Barsky, an incredible man who really created the MASH units that we used in Korea by taking a truck and turning it into an operating room and driving it up to the front lines and operating on the soldiers almost within minutes after they were hit. Barsky got a group of people together, raised money, and we had a very wide support. I always say everyone from Arnold Roosevelt to Mrs. Lehman contributed to this, and we bought an old convent in Toulouse and turned it into a hospital. And the hospital was maintained by the Unitarians, and we supported the hospital. So the Joint Anti-Fascist Refugee Committee was chiefly a money-raising group in support of this hospital in Toulouse. But we had a large list of contributors. And the House Committee on Un-American Activities, Mr. Rankin's committee, subpoenaed our books, which meant that everyone who had given a dollar to our committee, and this was at the worst moment of what we call McCarthyism today, that everyone who had given us money would be subpoenaed by the House Committee and would suffer through that subpoena. We couldn't do it. So we refused to surrender the books, and we were all sent to jail. We fought it all the way up to the Supreme Court, which refused to take our case, and finally we went to jail in 1950. What is very interesting is that in the record of my hearing, they expunged the following material. In the course of their questioning, as they did with everyone, They asked me whether I was in the service of a foreign agent, or was I a foreign agent? And I said, yes, I'm in the service of an authority. And they said, is this authority outside of the United States? I said, yes. They said, do you obey orders from them? I said, yes. And at that point, they got so excited, I thought they would pop their skins because they had finally found. And they said, are you ready, Mr. Fast, to name the authority? And I said, yes, I'll name the authority. They said, very well, name it. And I said, God. He said, get that bastard out of here. I'll give them a shred of the doubt that they were referring to me and not to God. But so that was my high moment. And they expunged it from the record, which I felt very bad about. But these were star chamber proceedings. No lawyer was allowed to be with you. You were there all alone. And it was difficult. The question was, they wanted to entrap me. I had nothing to hide or to be entrapped with. But they were quite a group of men.
Legendary author Howard Fast. We'll be back with him in just a minute here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Democracy Now!'s Jeremy Scahill as we continue our conversation with author Howard Fast at his home in Old Greenwich, Connecticut.
Many of your books are semi-autobiographical, and you portray in a number of books the experience of people who were jailed during the McCarthy era. Could you talk about some of the hardship that people jailed during the McCarthy era faced while in prison?
Well, this it's somewhat different. See, the Commissioner of Federal Prisons then, in the first place, I believe there were only 17,000 people in federal prisons then. Today we have in prison or going to prison or on parole over 2 million people, the largest amount of prisoners of any country in the world. It's as a matter of fact, every prisoner costs the American taxpayer $35 a day. So multiply the days of the year by $35 and multiply that by 2 million, and you get a notion of what our lunatic drug policy, our demented prison policy, is costing us. But when I went to prison, the federal prisons had a wonderful man as the top director of the federal prison system. His name was James Bennett. And Bennett called a group of psychologists together, of penal psychologists and criminal psychologists, and asked them to design a modern prison. And the first thing they did was to say you had to do away with the wall. And up, if you have no wall, no prisoner can escape. And they set up this prison at Mill Point in West Virginia. It covered about, I would say 10 acres. And there were army bunkhouses there. No door was ever locked, no wall, just a circle of signs, and each sign said, "Stay inside." Now, the prisoners sent there, no prisoner had more than 2 years left to serve when he was sent there. And the penalty for escaping was 5 years. So in the 18 or 20 years that this prison existed, only about a dozen men had tried to escape. And when they escaped, they had just walked out, gone home to whatever town or village they came from, and the warden would phone the local sheriff and he'd pick them up, send them back. Everyone worked at the prison, and while I hate prison, I hate the whole concept of prison, I must say this was the most intelligent and humane prison probably that existed in America. And the warden, a man by the name of Tiemann, was a very decent man, a very decent man. And so I hate to say that I enjoyed the experience, but I had always had a feeling that a writer should be in prison for some time at least, just so you write about, so you could write about what it means to be in prison. I think a writer should see a little bit of prison, a little bit of war. Neither of these things can be properly invented. So that was my prison. Now, the book you referred to is called The Pledge. And I tell the story of a man who is sent to this prison because he refuses to name names before the House Un-American Committee. He was not raped, but he was... I selected the one prisoner in our prison to use as a model for this, who was a kind of an insane thug. He worked in the garage, prison garage. So I set out a confrontation between him and this man. Aside from this, I have serious complaints about my being sent to prison, because I had done nothing to be sent to prison. I committed no crime, but I have no complaints against the prison itself.
I wanted to ask quickly about some of your earlier works, for example, The Passion of Sacco and Vanzetti. For young listeners today, Sacco and Vanzetti, I bet, does not ring a bell. Why were they, these two anarchists, significant in your life and in the history of the United States?
Well, they were significant because their case, and they were both put to death, their case was one of a great many innocent men who were put to death or sent to jail for long periods of time on the basis that they opposed the government. Now, an anarchist is not a bomb thrower. Anarcho-syndicalism is a way of thinking. It's a movement. And what it means in the crudest, briefest way is ownership of factories by the men who work in these factories. So the anarchist movement is not essentially, it has nothing to do with this vision of anarchists as destroyers or bomb throwers. Sacco and Vanzetti were two Italian working men who preached, to one extent or another, the anarchist philosophy. For this, they were framed for a murder that they did not commit, and the evidence against them was so small, so poor, and so manipulated that it really aroused the conscience of America. And thousands of men and women in the 1920s, late 1920s, were drawn in this movement to save Sacco and Vanzetti. And it was futile, and they were put to death. I wrote the book because this was the kind of a drama that had meaning far beyond the contents of the story. It might have been a story about John Brown, who was also put to death for his attack on the slaveholders. It could have been the story of Joe Hill, who was shot to death by a firing squad in Utah because he was a leader of the mine workers there. The story was repeated over and over throughout our history, but I felt that by telling the story of Sacco and Vanzetti, it could be highlighted.
Could you talk about the impact that the execution of the Rosenbergs had on you?
Well, that is something that stays with me. I don't know how much of it is known now, but certainly every listener remembers that what's-his-name, the CIA, who betrayed the CIA for Soviet money and who sent a number of CIA workers to their deaths, did not get the death sentence. And the Department of Justice G-Man, who went into being a spy for the Soviet Union and was finally caught, did not get the death sentence. The death sentence was reserved for the Rosenbergs. And there's much I could say about the Rosenberg case. The movement to save the Rosenbergs was begun by a man called Julian Trupin, T-R-U-P-I-N, a wonderful, wonderful man who was one of my dearest friends and myself. We began that movement, and it grew from there. And we did it because we felt that under the circumstances, they were not guilty. There's a long, involved story to this, and I don't want to take up the rest of this interview with it, but I must tell you this, that I went to my dentist during, I can't give the exact date, but it was just before Judge Kaufman pronounced the death sentence on the Rosenbergs. As I sat in the waiting room of the dentist, a man came out, wiping his eyes, and walked through and left. The dentist came out and he said, "Howard, you know who that was?" I said, "No, who was it?" "That was Judge Kaufman." Then the dentist tells me that on the dentist chair, in the dental chair, he told the dentist that he was called to Washington by President Truman, and that Truman showed him a folder which contained enough evidence against Kaufman's brother to send him to jail for the rest of his life for tax fraud. And he said, "Make your choice. Either you send the Rosenbergs to their deaths, deliver a verdict of death in the electric chair, or your brother spends the rest of his life in jail." Now, my dentist, and Kaufman said to my dentist, "I'm going out of my mind." He said, "I pleaded with Truman that if I do this, I will be an outcast among the Jews for the rest of my life. Don't lay this on me." Truman showed him no mercy. Either your brother goes to jail or you sentence the Rosenbergs to death. My dentist said to Kaufman, "You can't ask me about what you should do. For God's sake, go to your rabbi." He said, "I went to my rabbi, and the rabbi said I must follow my own conscience," which is a very neat way of getting out of it. Anyway, that was the incident that happened in my dentist's waiting room. I don't believe many people know about this story.
That's what I call filling in history.
Yes, it fills in a bit of history. And Kaufman sentenced them to death, and they died.
Now, in 1953, you were awarded the Stalin International Peace Prize, and Paul Robeson actually presented it to you. Now, I know that you had trouble with the non-aggression pact signed between Stalin and Hitler, and you also were influential in canceling the visit of a Russian musician who was going to participate in a concert with a Nazi supporter. Could you talk about how you ended up breaking with the Communist Party?
Well, I would say that less than breaking with the Communist Party broke. It ended. It came to an end. The Communist Party, as I knew it, that small party in America, came to an end with the 20th Congress of the Soviet Communist Party. This was the Congress in Moscow where Khrushchev spoke for several hours. He delivered a speech of 20,000 words. There was a Hungarian communist present, and this Hungarian sold his copy of the speech. The speech was only given to those who were there at this Congress. He sold his copy to the CIA. And they gave it to the State Department. The State Department gave it to the New York Times. The editor of the New York Times called he called the editor of the Daily Worker. And he said, "We have the Khrushchev speech. Do you want it?" He said, "We're going to publish it in tomorrow's paper, in full, 20,000 words. And Johnny said, "Yes, we want it." And he called a meeting of the whole staff, and we sat there, and this was read to us. And we heard this speech, and many of us wept, because we did not know and would not believe the truth about the Soviet Union. We had erected a socialist state to our beliefs and to our dreams, and this, for us, was the Soviet Union. And we heard this speech read there, and a wonderful man, a good friend, had been the Daily Worker correspondent in Moscow for 2 years. And he said to Johnny Gates, "Do you believe now that if I were caught with a copy of the New York Times in Moscow, I would be sent to prison?" Then Joe told us this story he had heard in Moscow, that Stalin always kept a revolver by his desk. And when a woman's committee for relief in the Ukraine, where there was a famine, begged Stalin's wife to go to him and beg him to send food to the Ukraine, she went to him. She dropped to her knees and wept and pleaded with him. And he took his revolver and shot her through the head. When we told this story to the New York Times, they refused to publish it. They said, "It's unbelievable. And we can't publish something that's absolutely unbelievable." It was unbelievable to us, too, but we knew it was the truth. Because Joe Clark, our correspondent in Moscow, got it from sources that knew it was the truth. With that meeting of the staff of the Daily Worker, I think the Communist Party of America came to an end. The next day, the Daily Worker was the only paper in the world that published the full 20,000 words of Khrushchev's text. And once that was published, there was no more Communist Party. But we had to publish it. There was no way we could not publish it.
Howard Fast, acclaimed novelist and author of more than 86 books, speaking to him in his home in Old Greenwich, Connecticut. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230 for a cassette copy. That's 1-800-735-0230. We'll be back with Howard Fast in just a minute here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Jeremy Scahill as we continue our conversation with Howard Fast, activist, novelist, author of more than 86 books.
Having been a member of the Communist Party for more than a decade, how did this paradigm shift affect your worldview and affect your writing?
Well, I had already felt what it meant to be blacklisted with Spartacus. No publishing company would publish Spartacus. I published it myself, and it became a bestseller.
And Spartacus was about the slave revolt?
The slave revolt in ancient times against Rome. After I left the party, it made front page news in the New York Times. And the blacklist for me ended. But what really ended the blacklist, smashed it to shreds, was the making of the movie Spartacus. Because Dalton Trumbo, who wrote the screenplay along with me, he wrote part of it. I wrote about a third of it. Trumbo was also known as a member of the Communist Party and had been imprisoned. And his name was on the screenplay, and the picture broke through. And when Kennedy played an early version of the picture at the White House, then that was the end of the blacklist. Of course, the real end of the tyranny of that time, and J. Edgar Hoover and Senator McCarthy came when Eisenhower was elected president. And while people don't give him the credit, he should have a lot of the credit of making short shrift of McCarthy in the Army hearing. Actually, although it's little understood, what we call the McCarthy time was really the Truman time. Truman issued an executive order for every non-elected official to take a loyalty oath in which you swore that you were never a member of the Communist Party or an associate of anyone who was a member of the party. And this spread like wildfire. State after state picked it up. And literally hundreds and hundreds of teachers lost their jobs and became unemployable. It wreaked havoc in Hollywood, as most people know. And for years, some of the best people in Hollywood could not find work. It was picked up by a supermarket magnat who published a book called Red Channels, which had the names of everyone who had been accused of being a communist. Also included was the name of the then Secretary of State and a number of other people in the government who were as far from being communists as Truman was. But I think that the bomb that finally exploded this was the film Spartacus.
Now, there were some people that came out of the House Un-American Activities Committee hearings strengthened by their experience. And you talked about your jail experience. But there are others whose lives were absolutely devastated. Could you talk about some of those lives of people who were devastated by the House Un-American Activities Committee, whether it was by their careers being ruined or by the fact that they had talked to the committee and perhaps named names?
It worked both ways. One of those who named names, Ilya Kazan, suffered for years. And
why did he do it?
I think any of those, all of those who did it, were afraid. You know, it's great to be a hero when your country is behind you and the flags are waving and the media is trumpeting your glories and so forth. But to be a hero when you're alone in that House hearing room and to know that if you don't name names, you will never work again in your profession, that you will be ruined financially, that your friends will shun you. This is something else. At least three people I know of at the time killed themselves after this. One of the men who killed himself had named names. Two others didn't name names, but they were so thoroughly ruined in their craft that they saw no way out. If you were a teacher, you would never teach again at any high school, college, university. And fear is a funny thing. You never know how afraid you can be until you confront a situation which threatens you. And it threatens in a variety of ways. So people did not name names and suffered. People named names and suffered again. It was a strange time that's almost impossible to recreate today.
Again, our guest, renowned author Howard Fast. Another chapter of history is one that continues through today, and it's how we ended up first talking just a little while ago on Democracy Now!, and it is the story and life of Paul Robeson, who is a dear friend of yours, Paul Robeson, who you knew through these very difficult times. And as I was wondering, as we move into the 100th anniversary of the birth of the great activist, scholar, actor, singer, athlete, Renaissance man, who is Paul Robeson, if you could talk a little about your friendship with him.
Well, he was an extraordinary man. I'll repeat some of the facts that should be well known now, and I hope will be better known. He was the first black man to play on a football team of white college. He was a brilliant athlete and a brilliant scholar. He was second or third in his class, and he delivered the valedictorian speech. He then went to law school and got his law degree and passed his bar. When he sang at various opportunities that he had then as a young man, he realized that he had a unique voice. I don't think there was ever a voice like it. He dedicated himself to the struggle against racism. He wrote his valedictorian address on the question of racism. He never veered from that struggle. He supported, in the worst Senator McCarthy days, he supported the handful of people who refused to be silenced. For this, he was called before the Un-American Committee, whose questions he refused to answer. Internationally, he was too gigantic a figure to be put in jail. It wasn't practical, so they did not proceed against him. But this was a man who, before he went before the House Un-American Committee, day or two before, had dinner at my house, and he said, "What am I going to tell them when they ask me whether I'm a communist?" And I said, "You tell them you're not a communist. You never were a communist." He said, "But then I've sung before the Abraham Lincoln Brigade in Spain. I've sung for the Spanish Republicans. I've sung for the Soviet Army that liberated Germany. I've sung everywhere, and all of these people think I'm a communist. And if I go down there and say I'm not a communist, how will I ever face them again?" The result was that he simply refused to answer their questions. Again, I could go on and on talking about Paul Robeson.
But just to clarify, on that point, it wasn't that he wanted to deceive people into thinking he was a communist, right? But rather that to say he wasn't was to say that there was something wrong with them?
He didn't want to face the fact that he had never joined the Communist Party. "How can I explain it?" he asked. Now, that's an odd thing to think today, the way history unfolds via the media. But history is one thing and the media is something else, and the two of them rarely connect.
Would you include Paul Robeson among those who were broken by the McCarthy period?
Yes, he was. Utterly broken. After the committee called him, he could not sing in any concert hall, could not play in any film, could not act on any stage. The only place he could sing was, excuse me, before left-wing audiences or in black churches. He was terribly disheartened, terribly broken by it. He could sing in Europe, and he did, to overwhelming crowds, but that is different. During the blacklist, my books were published everywhere in the world, but in America. But that meant nothing to me. If the Czechs published my books, I couldn't read Czech. If someone else published my books, I couldn't read the reviews. I wanted them published here in America, and that couldn't be done.
Kind of like hearing an echo of your own voice.
Yes, only an echo. I was more fortunate than most because my books could be published and I could get royalties from abroad. Most of them couldn't.
I heard you recently speak at Long Island University, which had an all-day retrospective or series of speeches about Paul Robeson. And you talked about the Peekskill concert, when he was able to sing before thousands of people, but the price that everyone paid for that concert.
Yes, that was a terrible incident. A great crowd gathered to hear him speak in these picnic grounds. And we had a wall around the place, a wall of human beings. And a dozen men around Paul, because they had threatened to kill him.
Veterans of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade fighting Spain's Franco.
Most of them were veterans of the Lincoln Brigade, most of the men around Paul. They did root out of the woods and the hillside above the valley two men with rifles who were there to kill Paul. The police would not arrest them, and nothing happened to them. The concert went peacefully, and Paul sang his heart out. But meanwhile, the hoodlums, protected by the police and state troopers, had gathered piles of rocks at every overpass leading out of the place. And as the people left, their cars were hammered by rocks and smashed, and dozens of people had to be hospitalized. And it was a terrible scene. This was an enormous incident, which is totally forgotten. Not even a footnote in the history books of the time.
Howard Fast, how do you want to be remembered by generations to come?
To remember me will not accomplish a great deal, but I think to read the books that I have written, these books have a power of their own, an existence of their own. So the blacklist is just wearing off. I know that in a number of colleges, they're beginning to teach courses in my work. That's something new. When I'm dead, and if the books are around, that's more than I could have ever dreamed of.
Well, I'm happy to note that despite your smoking of that cigar, you are not dead, and you grace us with your you grace us with your presence. You continue to grace us with your presence, and I want to thank you very much for spending this time with us.
I only smoke cigars when I work, and being interviewed is very hard work.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much for letting me get some of this off my mind. You think you have enough?
Well, Howard Fast, we will never have enough of you or your work, and again, we thank you. Well, folks, that does it for this edition of Democracy Now! If you'd like to order a cassette copy of this interview with Howard Fast, you can call the Pacifica Archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman with Jeremy Scahill.